This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're joined today by 90.7 health reporter Abe Abariah. Abe, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also joining us, Orlando City Commissioner for District 6 and President and CEO of Orange Blossom Family Health, Bakari Burns. Thanks for being here as well, Commissioner.
Yeah, my pleasure. Great to be with you.
So we're talking about the phased reopening of businesses and other parts of the city and what the health risks may be to different communities as that rolls out. You can reach out to us with your questions and comments on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. What are you doing during full phase one of the reopening? Have you ventured back out to restaurants or maybe taken a haircut that you hadn't gotten in a couple of months? Have you gotten a coronavirus test or are you planning to do so? And what's top of mind for you as the country slowly reopens? Where does your health fit into that? We're on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Commissioner Bakari Burns, I want to start with you, and you're just a few months, I guess, now into your very first term as commissioner, and yeah. Lo and behold, we're in the middle of a nationwide, a global crisis. How's that going?
Well, it definitely has changed things up. We had a lot of plans focused on infrastructure for our district, but now we've really focused to COVID response. And so we're doing all that we can to help provide relief to so many of our community members who are hurting. Mm-hmm. So we're doing things such as food distributions, supply distributions, and just providing that additional support that so many of individuals in our community need.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your other role, you're head of the Orange Blossom Family Clinic in Orlando, and that serves low-income families who need health care. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how your clinic has faced the pandemic and what kind of impact it's had on how you treat patients or even like the volume of patients you've been seeing in the last couple of months.
Sure. Well, great question. COVID-19 has really forced us and other healthcare providers to really reevaluate and change how we care for our communities. We nearly had to pivot overnight. So when the governor executed his executive orders of reducing or stopping all dental services except for emergency dental services and reducing a lot of the medical services that can be provided, we saw about a 65% decline in the number of patients that were coming to us. So we had to respond to that. But also what it did is we had to reconfigure our waiting rooms for social distancing. Mm-hmm. But also we started to set up tents outside to ensure that we were able to screen individuals taking the temperature before they came into to the health facility. So there are a lot of different things. But one of the main things that we've had to pivot to doing is fast-forwarding our implementation of telehealth services. Mm-hmm. So we had some level of telehealth, but almost overnight we had to pivot to doing probably about 30-40% of the medical services as well as our behavioral health during telehealth. So we're constantly pivoting, looking at the needs of our community. And one of the things that we're recognizing and that we're very concerned about, a lot of our patients who have chronic conditions, because they've been staying at home and advised to not come out, a lot of them have not been following up and accessing their prescriptions, mm-hmm. going without their medications. So that's a large concern of ours, and we're putting things in place to ensure that we're reaching out to individuals when we're notified that they haven't picked up their prescriptions for their maintenance medications, to reach out to them to see if they need them, to have them delivered, if they can come get them. So really we're just trying to do everything we can to ensure that our patients and our community have the continued access to quality care that they need.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With us are Commissioner Bakari Burns from Orlando's District 6 and 90.7's health reporter Abe Abariah. We're talking about the reopening of businesses as restaurants, gyms and bars down the track open as well. Wondering what your concerns may be as you venture out to some of those places. You can tweet us your questions at WMFE Orlando. Abe, right now county leaders are discussing how some theme parks and attractions could reopen. What do we know about some of the efforts being made by those in the tourism industry to minimize the spread of coronavirus?
That's absolutely right, Matt. Right now, we know that there have been more than a dozen smaller theme parks that have kind of gone through the initial clearance to reopen in Orange County. We're kind of waiting for sort of the bigger ones, like Universal is planning on presenting to the county in the afternoon. So we haven't had a chance to take a look at their plan yet, but we have seen some of the plans from the smaller parks, like, you know, WonderWorks and Fun Spot, those kind of locations. And one of the, you know, the things that they're looking at, they're trying to have social distancing, you know, kind of having markers on the ground so people know how to stay 6 feet apart, maybe, you know, changes in how rides are seated so that there's more distance between people when they're actually on a ride. They're, you know, more sanitation, more hand washing. Staff will be wearing protective face coverings. They're going to be doing health screenings of staff and temperature checks and you know, asking the people that are working at the park, you know, if they have any symptoms and requiring mm-hmm. them to stay home if they're sick. And kind of the big one is going to be, you know, just reduced capacity. 50% capacity is what sort of the marker in Orange County right now, the maximum. And we've seen a few of them that are, you know, want to open at even less capacity than that. But, you know, some of these, they're saying they're ready to open pretty much now this weekend or, you know, June 1st. I think a few of them are you know, that quick. So it's going to be interesting to see how Orlando kind of, you know, the lifeblood here, as one of our reporters mentioned, you know, described the tourism industry. It's definitely the lifeblood here, and it's going to be interesting to see how that comes back with the current pandemic we're in.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about how coronavirus is impacting some communities differently from others, and we're going to hear a little bit from Commissioner Regina Hill in a minute, who was at a mobile testing site earlier in the week, talking about the need to get more testing into certain communities because there are some communities that are more at risk. But Abe, talk about, for example, the impact of COVID-19 on communities of color, for example. What do we know about the disparities in the way this disease affects us?
We are absolutely seeing in the numbers an impact, a disparate impact on communities of color. Some of the studies that have come out already, one of the more recent ones found that 22% of U.S. counties that are disproportionately black account for 52% of the COVID-19 cases and 58% of the deaths. And when they kind of try and control for things like, you know, if a county is urban or rural, none of that stuff seems to matter. So it's definitely having an impact on, African-American community, Hispanic community. You know, we're seeing it here in Orange and Osceola and Seminole counties. It's not as acute as some of the other parts of the country, but, you know, this is definitely, it has brought to light what researchers and people in healthcare have known for a long time, which is that there is a very distinct healthcare divide and disparate impact on people of color. Mm-hmm. And this is just sort of reinforcing that. And there's some hope from researchers that, you know, knowing this now early in the crisis, you know, we might be able to, that there might be some efforts to, you know, fix that and change some of that disparate impact. It's going to inform policy on how you're, you know, targeting whether it's, you know, vaccines or different treatments and trying to get those out to different communities that are having a more difficult time. So there is a little bit of hope that you know, knowing what's going on right now with the racial impact of this, you know, could help change some of those outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I mentioned, the City of Orlando is standing up some of those mobile testing sites. They're doing that Tuesdays and Thursdays and rotating them throughout these commission districts in the city to get a bit better understanding of the data about the pandemic as more businesses reopen. Let's just take a listen to City Commissioner Regina Hill, who was at a testing site in West Orlando on Tuesday.
We really need to know our status, and we need to be tested. And I'd like to thank Mayor Dyer for his leadership and by making sure that we had testing here on the west side, because we were lagging behind. And we do know what COVID has revealed is all the health disparities in black and brown communities. So we really need to be tested so we can be proactive with getting proper health care. And then connecting the residents here in this area with the primary physician. So in order to get back to the new norm, we must be tested. But not just that, we still need to practice social distancing. We still need to practice proper hand washing techniques of 20 seconds. And it's so very important that you continue to wear your facial barriers, because the very life that you might save might be your own.
And that's Orlando City Commissioner Regina Hill speaking at a mobile testing location at the Northwest Community Centre on Tuesday. Commissioner Bakari Burns, let me kind of pivot to you for a moment and ask, does some of what Commissioner Hill is saying resonate with you when she talks about the need to kind of make up for a bit of lost time and testing in certain communities because there are some risks there?
Yes, definitely. Commissioner Hill and I definitely share in those thoughts that we have to ensure that our hard-to-reach, hard-to-serve communities have access to COVID-19 testing. One of the things I mentioned that we've been doing food distributions, mm-hmm. in our first few food distributions, I would see if it started at 10 o'clock, individuals would start to line up at about 8 and wait, for about 2 hours. So I got with my city staff as well as my healthcare staff and said, we have a population that's here waiting for food. We need to do COVID testing while they're in their cars waiting for their food to be distributed. So we had a food distribution at the Dr. James R. Smith Center on May 2nd. Mm-hmm. And while we served 700 families with food, we were able to conduct 200 COVID-19 tests. And so I think that's the type of thinking we have to do, is kind of think outside of the box and do testing in non-conventional ways, as opposed to just saying we're providing testing, please come. Let's see where people are gathering, where they're coming to get food, and let's see if we can coordinate some testing during those food distributions. So following that food distribution, my health center partnered with Commissioner Hill at the Northwest Community Center and provided COVID-19 testing at that distribution, what we did over about 150. So it's imperative that we do make sure that everyone has access to COVID-19 testing. But also I wanted to mention our community members who may be experiencing homelessness. Mm-hmm. We were fortunate again to partner with the Homeless Services Network and the City of Orlando, and we conducted about 100 COVID-19 testing in two of our shelters, our local shelters. So we went right into the shelter and provided the COVID-19 testing. And there were some encouraging numbers that we revealed. And when we did those 100 tests, there was not one positive COVID-19 test that came back in our homeless population. So that's encouraging because, our homeless population are more vulnerable to contracting communicable disease, not just COVID-19, but just in general. Mm-hmm. But that type of testing in that population, revealing that we didn't have one case in those that were tested in that setting, was very encouraging. But also I have to give props to Lisa Portelli from the City of Orlando and Mayor Dyer, because they led the development of an isolation and recovery shelter that's designed to provide a isolation and recovery for individuals who are experiencing homelessness, who may have been tested positive for COVID-19 or who have been exposed. So, mm-hmm. again, as a community, we have to come together, gather our resources, and see how can we be innovative or think outside of the box when we're looking to deliver this much-needed testing in our communities. And also there's a lot of education that needs to happen. One of the things that I would hear when I would ask individuals had they gotten tested was they were concerned about the how the test is conducted.
Right.
They were saying, well, I hear that they're swabbing your brain and it hurts and it's very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so we had to educate individuals, one, that there's several different types of tests, but also that it may be a little uncomfortable, but it doesn't necessarily hurt. So we were fortunate that we received some testing swabs that weren't the pharyngeal tests that go deep. It's just a tickle within the nose.
Right.
And when we communicated that, individuals were more excited about getting tested, and we're fortunate that many have gotten tested.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking with health reporter Abe Abaraya and Orlando City Commissioner Bakari Burns about the phased reopening of businesses and other parts of the city and what the health risks may be to different communities. You can reach out to us with your questions and comments, whether they're concerns about business or health. We're on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. We'll continue the conversation when we return. Stay with us. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking with health reporter Abe Abaraya and Orlando City Commissioner Bakari Burns about the phased reopening of businesses and other parts of the city, what the health risks may be to different communities. You can reach out with your questions and comments on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. If you're maybe one of these people who has decided that now's the time to venture out, go to a restaurant and take those precautions, or maybe you've gotten a haircut after a couple of months. Have you gotten a coronavirus test, or maybe you're planning to do so? I want to know what's top of mind for you as the country slowly reopens and where health fits into that. You can reach out with those questions and comments on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. John writes in, I had the COVID test a few weeks ago and was negative, but I'm still taking precautions. But I have sat down to eat and will continue to venture out. The mishandling of COVID has left us to our own devices, so we may as well move on with our lives. Thanks for reaching out with that comment, John. Bakari, it seems to me that there's kind of a patchwork of response in some ways to the pandemic and also the reopening. I mean, counties are kind of figuring things out for themselves. Cities are figuring out things for themselves a little bit. Do you feel like Orlando is going about it the right way in terms of reopening and how to do that safely and how testing fits into that?
Yes, I do. I support Mayor Dyer as well as Mayor Demings in their coordinated approach to how our community starts to reopen. And speaking with both of them, I do know that they're using the data to let it drive our decisions. I was on a call earlier this morning, with a representative from one of the local hospitals, and they mentioned that there were only 5 individuals in their hospital system because of COVID-19. So mm-hmm. those are a lot of encouraging data. If we look at the percentage positive of individuals who've been tested, again, that's positive and encouraging for us because we have a low percentage of positivity. So I think that we are going about it the right way. We're being very focused on the safety first. We all want to get back out and go to our favorite restaurants or attend our favorite theme parks. But we have to keep in mind that safety first, because the last thing we want to do is to see a resurgence of this to where we have to shut down completely again. But I wanted to mention something that oftentimes gets lost in this discussion, and that's the protection of our essential workers. And we always hear about our essential healthcare workers and our healthcare providers. But, you know, I think this COVID-19 has really put a focus on workers who are deemed essential, like our, and we'll be forever indebted to our first responders and our essential workers who put their lives on the line throughout this pandemic. And so they've always been essential, but now the spotlight is on them. And we have to make sure that we're advocating, one, that they have the necessary PPE protection, but also that they have access to quality, affordable healthcare services as well mm-hmm. as testing. Because unfortunately, many of our essential workers are oftentimes minority and women. Many of them are at jobs that don't provide health insurance, but they're still required to remain at work or to come to work and risk exposure. Mm-hmm. But the key is, if they're infected, many of them do not have the necessary job protections that will allow them to safely isolate and recover, because they work for small companies that have less than 50 employees. And so these small companies that have less than 50 employees don't have to comply with the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Act, which would give them job protection for at least 2 weeks. So I want us to continue to think about and advocate for the safety of our so many of our essential workers that are working every day, allowing us to, you know, to safely stay at home and quarantine mm-hmm. at home. So we as a community have to, when you see one, you encounter one, thank them for the work that they do, because they're the reason why we're able to safely stay home.
Right, but also, right. And it's sort of, I think the conversation around what is an essential worker is reframed a bit. I mean, you mentioned the healthcare workers, right. the frontline workers, but to your point also, it's grocery store employees, it's people who are keeping those businesses running and have been doing, right. you know, for the last couple of months or so. I just wanted to bring in another kind of perspective here, and we're getting a tweet from Ricardo who writes in, a question, actually, what's the deal with Rebecca Jones? Did her firing expose a conspiracy to hide COVID-19 data? Was she criminally negligent in her duties? And it's a very interesting question. It's something that's been on a lot of people's minds, thinking about data and testing. Abe, let me throw that to you. There have been a lot of questions raised about testing. What kind of issues are public health agencies dealing with as they monitor cases? Just if you could weigh in on that.
The Rebecca Jones story absolutely has kind of blown up this week. You know, if people aren't familiar, this is Rebecca Jones was one of the architects of the dashboard that Florida has for COVID-19. This is the one that, you know, you see all over the place. It's been hailed as sort of this great, you know, model of transparency where you could go through and you could see, you know, by county, by zip code, by, you know, at certain points, by race and ethnicity, and she basically, you know, she put a note out to an email serve, an email listserv, basically saying, look, you know, starting as of May 5th, my department's no longer in charge of it. This is because I've advocated for transparency, so I would expect that, you know, that's the reason why I'm being pushed out of this role. So you can expect less transparency, because there had been some issues with the dashboard kind of going down. Some of the underlying data that researchers were relying on to be able to download was disappearing and coming back up. And, you know, when some of the reporters reached out to her, she not only, you know, reemphasized some of those initial allegations that the state was, you know, wanting to be less transparent, but was also saying that she had been asked to, you know, manipulate data to make an argument for reopening the case, and that was some of her issues. Now, the governor has come out very strong against that. You know, there's been a lot of pushback from you know, that perspective as well. Mm-hmm. There's also been a lot of calls from lawmakers to have, you know, a more thorough investigation into her allegations and to see, right. you know, what is borne out with that. But some of it has been, there's been some fantastic reporting by the Tampa Bay Times that has looked at some of the emails that they received that seem to corroborate her version of events. The state has also released an email from Rebecca to one of her supervisors where she kind of makes it sound like, you know, oh, I talked to a reporter, maybe I made a mistake and made it sound like things were worse than they are. Mm. But I think we've got a little bit of sound of the governor yesterday when he was in Orlando with Vice President Mike Pence, where he's talking about this. It's a long soundbite, about 2.5 minutes, but I think it's worth listening to the whole thing.
One, she's not a data scientist. She's somebody that's got a degree in journalism, communication, and geography. She is not involved in collating any data. She does not have the expertise to do that. She is not an epidemiologist. She is not the chief architect of our web portal. That is another false statement. And what she was doing was she was putting data on the portal, which the scientists didn't believe was valid data. So she didn't listen to the people who were her superiors. She had many people above her in the chain of command. And so she was dismissed because of that and because of a bunch of different reasons about how she did. Come to find out, she's also under active criminal charges in the state of Florida. She's being charged with cyber stalking and cyber sexual harassment. So I've asked the Department of Health to explain to me how someone would be allowed to be charged with that and continue on, because this was many months ago. I have a zero tolerance policy for sexual harassment. So her supervisor dismissed her because of a lot of those reasons, and it was a totally valid way, but she should have been dismissed long before that. Our data is available. Our data is transparent. In fact, Dr. Birx has talked multiple times about how Florida has the absolute best data. So any insinuation otherwise is just typical partisan narrative trying to be spun. And part of the reason is that because you got a lot of people in your profession who waxed poetically for weeks and weeks about how Florida was going to be just like New York. Wait 2 weeks, Florida's going to be next, just like Italy. Wait 2 weeks. Well, hell, we're 8 weeks away from that, and it hasn't happened. Not only do we have a lower death rate, well, we have way lower deaths generally, we have a lower death rate than the Acela Corridor, D.C., everyone up there. We have a lower death rate than the Midwest, Illinois, Michigan, Indiana, Ohio. But even in our region, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Florida has the lower death rate. And I was the number one landing spot from tens of thousands of people leaving the number one hot zone in the world to come to my state. So we've succeeded, and I think that people just don't want to recognize it because it challenges their narrative, it challenges their assumption, so they got to try to find a boogeyman. Maybe it's that there are black helicopters circling the Department of Health. If you believe that, I got a bridge in Brooklyn I'd like to sell you.
Last question.
That's Governor Ron DeSantis there talking about some of the things that he's pushing back on regards the data and testing. I do need to move on, though. I've got a question coming in from Brandon, who writes in that he writes, my business landlords are threatening to sue us over back rent. They're being slightly lenient, but at the same time threatening us into paying them. PPP grant may finally go through next week, but we've got payroll and expenses as well as rent. Brandon, thanks for reaching out with your concern. Bakari, let me throw that one to you. Is that something that you're having to kind of, are you fielding issues like that as well? People worried about, you know, where they're going to be as far as, is their business going to still be in the place that it is right now, and some of those issues around tenancy, et cetera?
Yes, we hear that almost daily, you know, concerns from the small businesses. One of the things, there's a couple of promising things. One is that Orange County will be receiving some CARES funding, and they've dedicated about $72.9 million to support small businesses and each small business who actually brick and mortar business operating within Orange County or the municipalities within Orange County will be eligible to receive a grant, not a loan, but a grant for up to $10,000. So I encourage everyone to look at that program, put in their application as early as you can, because, again, these are resources that will only be for our local community. So I encourage everyone to apply for those. Mm-hmm. But yeah, those are concerns that we're hearing, you know, about the rent, being able to pay the rent, utilities, but also, you know, being able to bring their employees back as well.
Yeah, and one of the things we heard from Commissioner Regina Hill the other day was she was concerned about the availability of personal protective equipment, particularly for places like barbershops and salons. And I know the county has put in some resources there to make sure that small businesses can have access to that. But are you hearing from businesses saying, look, we're running out, we need more?
Well, not as of yet. I haven't heard them mention that they're running out. But everyone that I've spoken to who have taken advantage of that are very grateful for that. And what I've been hearing as well is that there's a large percentage of individuals that are visiting these businesses that already have or coming with their face coverings. So then that takes removes some of the burden from the businesses for providing those resources. Mm-hmm. So I haven't heard that they've run out personally, but I do know that, you know, the PPE will be constantly coming in, and we're hoping that this resource will remain available for the next foreseeable future.
Just in the last minute or so here, Abe, I wanted to circle back on the testing. And one thing that we are starting to see more of now is the antibody testing. Real quick, how important is that, and what is that going to tell us?
We're seeing more of it, and particularly because One Blood is now, if you make a donation, they'll do the antibody testing for that, mm-hmm. which is going to provide a lot of antibody testing for people. That gives you an indication of whether or not you had it. And so that, you know, people can use that to sort of make their own judgment about, okay, well, I've had the virus. We don't know 100% that, you know, having had the virus is going to mean that you have enough of the antibodies to definitely not get infected again. But it is a reasonable assumption to make that.
I've been speaking with 90.7 health reporter Abe Abariah and Orlando City Commissioner Bakari Burns about the phased reopening of businesses and what the health risks may be to different communities. Thank you both for joining us. And up next, we'll speak to Spectrum News 13 Chief Meteorologist Brian Carrick about the upcoming hurricane season. That's when Intersection returns. Stay with us. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. The official start of hurricane season is just under 2 weeks away, but already the first named storm of the 2020 season has spun up in the Atlantic, Tropical Storm Arthur. With the country still in the grip of the coronavirus pandemic, that's having an impact not only on how people prepare for the hurricane season, but also on forecasting. For more, we're joined by Brian Carrick. Brian Carrick, Spectrum News 13's Chief Meteorologist, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem, Matthew. Thank you for having me.
I want to just cast a look back to 2019 for a moment, if I could. It was kind of a bit of a funny season in some ways. I guess every hurricane season is unique, right? But what stands out for you when you think back to 2019, what we were expecting and what we ended up actually getting?
Sure. Well, we were looking at the potential for a slightly above average season, and we did end up above average. The big takeaway from 2019, I think, was Hurricane Dorian, and that's kind of what everybody seems to be discussing, even going in and talking about the 2020 hurricane season. Dorian was one mean storm, and the forecast models were all over the place, really drove us crazy trying to pin down exactly where this storm was going to end up. And obviously it stalled over the Bahamas, and the devastation was just unreal. We were very nervous here in Central Florida with that storm because it was sitting just off our coast, and some of the models waddled it in our direction, but thank goodness it stayed away. And overall, we got through last season with just a couple scares.
It's interesting just how big a difference a jog a couple of miles east or west can make, right? I mean, that can really be the difference between life and death for some folks, especially along the coast.
Yes, because if you see a storm jog just slightly west, and let's think back to Matthew, when it paralleled our Atlantic coast, it was literally 50 miles offshore. And had it wobbled just a little bit more to the west, we would have had some more inland destruction. Obviously, we had a lot of storm surge. And for those who were here back when Matthew skimmed the coastline, it took down parts of the A1A in Flagler County. But had that jaunted a little bit more west, it was just a matter of miles, and we could have had some devastation even into the Orlando Metroplex.
I guess the science of prediction is always improving, right? You're getting new tools all the time. You're able to get better data and sort of drill down in more detail about what storms are doing and where they're going. But thinking about Hurricane Dorian, what was it about that storm, do you think, that made it so difficult to get a fix on where it was going?
I think it was because it started slowing down and was getting caught up in a pattern that just held it in place. And the models weren't picking up on the stall. They were trying to pull it either toward the Florida Peninsula or taking it north and northeast. So when it started to stall and get kind of caught in the pattern that it was in, unfortunately, the models just weren't picking up on where it was headed. And the models do have a tough time sometimes with storms. You know, every storm is going to be different. The models are going to actually handle a storm differently every time. And that's why we have to look at so many different models, try and figure out what we're thinking, which model at the particular time may perform better than others. This year, unfortunately, with the coronavirus, we're not getting as much data out of the ships that are out in the ocean or the planes. There are fewer planes flying over the ocean. So the models are going to be a little different this year because they're not getting the information they need to actually give us, you know, the best pinpoint accuracy when it comes to the model run. So we need to dive in a little bit more in the meteorology and try and figure out which model this year is going to latch on and be the one to follow.
I think that's something that probably a lot of people wouldn't be aware of. I wonder if you could just kind of unpack that a little bit and explain how it is that you'll get extra data from basically everything that's out there. I mean, it sounds like everything can be a kind of a weather station in some regard.
Yes, you know, even commercial airplanes have weather instrumentation on them to give back the information. And ships at sea, not only do they have the instrumentation, but they also are relying on buoy information. And we will rely heavily on buoy information and data coming from the buoys and obviously weather stations on land. And that will be our heavily focused kind of way of going into this upcoming season. And as air traffic starts to pick up again and ship traffic gets back out there during the season, we will have more reliable information trickling in, and I think that will help. So we just have to remember that, you know, it just takes one storm, and we're focused on the storm, and we just need to be prepared before it moves in.
We had Tropical Storm Arthur out in the Atlantic earlier this week. What can you take away from that? I mean, the fact that we have a named storm out there before the official start of the season even. It's not the first time it's happened, obviously, but are there some trends that you're looking at there, and does that cause you a bit of concern as a meteorologist?
Well, this is our sixth year in a row with a named storm before the start of hurricane season, which is June 1st, and it runs through November 30th. So the sixth year in a row we've had a named storm prior to the start of the season itself. And it really doesn't set the stage for an upcoming season. As we've seen in the past, it can be a very busy season. It can be, you know, a fairly quiet season in the past 6 years. So just focusing on that one storm, it's all it takes. But looking ahead to this upcoming season, and a lot of the forecast groups that put together their forecasts for the season, they're saying an above average year. Now, the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasting, the European agency itself, is actually calling for an average to slightly above average forecast season ahead. And what they're all looking at is whether there's an El Nino or a La Nina. El Nino is a warming of the Pacific waters, which helps to keep our pattern a little quieter and the Atlantic a little cooler, or a La Nina, which is a cooling of the Pacific waters and a warming of the Atlantic. And there are indications that we're going into a La Nina fall, maybe even late summer, and that would tend to keep our sea surface temperatures warmer. And I think that's why we're looking at the potential for a more active season. But again, we don't know where these storms are going to hit. They might not hit Central Florida at all. It may be an active season and we don't get brushed, or we may see a storm or two, but it only takes one.
Those two weather patterns you talked about, La Nina and El Nino, are those the biggest factors in determining sea surface temperature? Or are there some other things you're looking at as well that also have an impact on how warm the ocean is and the intensity and number of storms we might get through the season?
Those are the two main factors that play into a season forecast. If there is a neutral year, it might be an average year of storms. But if you have an El Nino year, we disrupt that pattern. We have wind shear, winds aloft that are going in different directions and different speeds that help to kind of keep storms from developing. And the ocean isn't able to warm as much because of the pattern that sets up. Now, in a La Nina year, the pattern sets up that we heat the oceans a little faster in the Atlantic, and we don't have that wind shear. So those are the two main ones that help with not only kind of predicting what sea surface temperatures are going to be like, but also what the pattern will be and unfold heading into the season.
And these storms kind of, they're born over Africa, right? And sometimes things that are happening in the African continent can have an impact on the storms, like dust, for example. Are you able to sort of unpack a little bit about what goes on there, like at the birth of these storms, before they even hit the Atlantic and trundle their way across to hit Florida or brush Florida?
Sure. Well, and it depends on, you know, the time of season. It depends on which month, because certain months it's more of, say, a cold front dropping in, like as we work our way through June. Cold fronts dropping down, and even here in May with Arthur, a cold front is what helped to spin an area of low pressure up, and that's what developed Tropical Storm Arthur. So a front dropping south, areas of low pressure riding along it can sometimes kick into tropical gear. And so early on in the season, a lot of our storms try to kick out of the Western Caribbean or even the Gulf of Mexico because we are starting to warm things up. The African season is more the second half of the season. Those are the storms, though, that come off the coast of Africa. They spin up on the continent, and they roll across that Atlantic. And the Atlantic, depending on the temperatures, a lot of it is high-octane fuel. And you need sea surface temperatures of at least 80, 82 degrees and above to really fuel a hurricane. So as they're coming off the coast of Africa, rolling along, they're soaking up all that high-octane fuel, the warm waters, and that's why they're able to gain their strength. And that gives us some of our stronger hurricanes. And that, again, is usually the second half of the season, more late or mid to late August into mid-September. But dust does play a role. And if there is dust off the coast of Africa being pulled into the atmosphere, that dust chokes the storm itself and doesn't allow it to breathe.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm talking to Spectrum News 13's chief meteorologist, Brian Carrick, having a look back to past hurricane seasons and thinking about the upcoming season, which starts on June 1st. Thinking about the difference between the Gulf and the Atlantic, though, I mean, there are some pretty brutal storms that can spin up out of the Gulf of Mexico, right? I mean, thinking back just to 2018 and Hurricane Michael, which came along in October and was a very powerful storm, and I think it kind of caught people a bit on the hop, didn't it?
It developed very rapidly. And Matthew, I tell you, this storm itself, when it got developed off the coast of Central America as just tropical depression, it rolled quickly north. And, you know, I mentioned that very warm water. The sea surface temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico were approaching 90 at the time that Michael got its act together. And it ramped up very quickly. Now, we knew the storm was headed somewhere into the panhandle, so people had some time to prepare. But I believe that storm, as it got a little bit closer, ramped even more, and it made landfall as a Category 5 storm. It was the first Category 5 hurricane to hit the Florida Peninsula since Hurricane Andrew in 1992. So the storm itself, you know, brought unbelievable devastation up toward Mexico Beach and the Panhandle. But yeah, it ramped up fairly quickly, and I think some people who may have thought that it was not going to be as strong just thought, well, if it's a Category 2 or 3, we're going to be okay. Again, it doesn't matter the category. It could be a tropical storm. It still produced devastation like Michael did back in 2018.
You spend, you know, much of your time in the studio, right, like behind the weather desk and kind of looking at things from there. But do you get the chance very often to go out and actually see the impact of storms and some of the aftermath, like Dorian, for example, or even Hurricane Michael?
Actually, back in 2004, the very busy hurricane season of 2004, I was down covering hurricanes, both Francis and Jean. I had a chance to not only be in it for a while, I went into a studio and helped with coverage, and then afterward, I had a chance to drive around and see what had happened. When it came to Matthew, I went over to the coast afterward and was able to see some of the sand dune devastation of the A1A. And then during Hurricane Irma, when it crossed up and over the peninsula, I got out after that. And I actually live out on the west side of the metro. And even out toward me, a lot of the trees down and the roof damage, et cetera, I've had that chance. It's never fun. It's never fun to see. It's heartbreaking when people are trying to pick up the pieces after something has happened like that. But getting out and hearing their stories and hearing how they may have been prepared, it motivates us as a team to make sure that we are prepared and we're not scared.
And Hurricane Irma was kind of an interesting one too, because it was such a wide storm, right? It basically just bulldozed its way up the entire state of Florida.
It did, and it was one of those storms too where we waited and waited for a turn. And if you recall, it was coming up along Cuba's north shores, and we were waiting for the turn toward the Keys, and you know, the models were turning it a little sooner, then some of the models started trending slower, and then all of a sudden it turned, and it just came straight up. And I think if there was any saving grace is that the eye fell apart as it was rolling through Polk County. And because it weakened so fast, as storms like that roll onto land is the friction that helps to decelerate, slow it down a bit, and cause it to kind of broaden out and weaken. Although it does send the wind flow out farther, it tends to weaken the storm. So by the time it reached West Orange County and Lake County and Sumter County, it had weakened considerably over what it had done down in southern Florida and the Keys.
Mm-hmm. Meteorologists are pretty crucial in sort of getting messaging out, like, you know, well in advance of a storm. And a lot of that is basic information, especially for people who may be new to the state of Florida, like how to prepare, what kind of supplies you should lay in. I'm wondering, though, Brian, just sort of thinking back to the fact that we are still in a pandemic and there's a bit of an overlap between that. I mean, emergency managers must be a bit worried about what happens if, you know, if we are still in the throes of a pretty serious pandemic and a hurricane comes ashore. But from your perspective, thinking about the way your viewers respond, do you get the sense that there may be a little bit of preparation fatigue seeping in, like kind of the fact that we've been now in 2 months of people preparing for a different kind of disaster, and now we're in hurricane season and we're being told all over again, okay, you need to make sure you got the plan, you've got your supplies and everything. What about that psychological impact of something going on that long and flowing into hurricane season as well?
Sure. You know, it's a very delicate balance. It really honestly is. And I was very hesitant to jump into any talk of hurricane season when we started getting our first hurricane forecasts out from the forecasters, the national forecast groups that put those out. I was hesitant to really speak on that because we were really in the middle of this pandemic at that time. And even, you know, going in with Tropical Storm Arthur, we wanted to balance our coverage with, you know, it's gorgeous here, but we have our eye in the tropics, and you just don't want to scare people. And that's why you just kind of take that step back and you go in calm. And I think with people already prepared and having things at home and learning new ways of either ordering things in or just being together as families, I think the preparation is actually probably we are well on our way to being prepared for a storm that might head in our direction. And at that point, obviously, you're right, there might be some mental fatigue, but just going in and thinking about it and saying, you know what, we're prepared. We don't need to be scared. We're going to get through this storm. We've weathered a pandemic. And so I think once people start focusing on that, we'll get through it and we'll be just fine. And obviously, you know, we're such a resilient community. You hear that every year. I know it's a cliche, but we are a resilient community here in Central Florida, and people do get back on their feet, help their neighbors out, and get back to life.
And you've been holding some town hall discussions with folks. What kind of questions are people asking? I mean, does the pandemic factor in the things that the viewers want to know?
They do want to know, but they also have, you know, expressed concern about just the fatigue of all of this going on, heading into a hurricane season and how we're still in the beginning of it. But there's still a lot of curious folks who are moving, and our population is still, you know, exploding. And so you've got a lot of new folks who have a lot of questions about hurricanes, who may have never been through a storm like that. But we also have to keep in mind, we're going into our wet season with our daily afternoon storms that could produce winds and lots of lightning. So I think, you know, just knowing every year we go through the same process, people kind of take pause and realize it's a season. We just need to be prepared.
Mm-hmm. And thinking about those winds, I mean, you've got tornadic activity to think about as well. To your point earlier, it's not just a hurricane that you need to be aware of. It's also some of the smaller storms that can be just as devastating depending on where you are.
Yeah, and, you know, we got very lucky just last month with the tornado that touched down near Lake Monroe in Seminole County. And it had developed over Lake Mary, and had that touched down in a populated area, we would have had some serious trouble. But as it was, it developed over Lake Monroe, and it rolled for a couple miles and didn't produce any damage. But that's just another thing that we were thinking about. And, yeah, we have to kind of keep an eye on just our general daily thunderstorms heading through our summer season.
Are there any new products that you're rolling out this season, Brian, as far as new methods of getting information out there or forecasting tools that you're using?
Well, we're always, you know, trying to make sure that we've got the very latest in not only technology, but education. And we're doing various things online to get ourselves prepared. And we're going through courses to make sure that we are up to speed on what the very latest information is heading into the season. We are going to be rolling out a new tool. I cannot really mention much of that because it's coming midsummer, but we will be rolling out a new tool that will help us and give us a clearer vision of these storms moving forward from midsummer, I'd say, on. And again, you'll be hearing more about that coming up sometime probably in June.
You were talking a little bit earlier about the ships and the fact that you get some weather information from ships at sea, commercial airliners, etc. Do you get a little bit of the same kind of information coming in on a smaller scale from people maybe sort of tweeting in or saying, you know, sending you a text from a certain area saying, hey, there's some tree damage here, or, you know, there's a roof missing here and there? Like, does that sort of help you get a more complete picture of what's going on?
Definitely. Anytime we can get a storm report, we don't want anybody putting themselves in any kind of danger to get any reports whatsoever. But if they get reports, obviously report it to the local authorities, and then they're aware of it and they can send crews out and then let us know as well, because then we pass it along to the viewers on air, and you can pass it along to your listeners as well, because that information does go into, say, it's a tornado, and it goes into making a report on the size of the tornado, the strength of the tornado, or if there's an area that people need to avoid. And not only getting texts and calls and emails, but we also have a tremendous ham radio group in Central Florida that help with that as well, passing along that information. And it's key to helping us make sure that we've got the most precise coverage.
Well, Brian Carrick is Spectrum News 13's chief meteorologist. We've been talking about the upcoming storm season, what to expect and how to prepare. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Matthew. Appreciate it.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. There are a lot of things that people need right now, and information is one of them. Donating to WMFE is an easy way to support the news you and so many others rely on. Give back right now. Visit WMFE.org to get started. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.